the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll actually say it, boys and girls, just in case there might be some out there. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the line with me I have the elder bald one, rather than the younger bald one. Elder Baldy, Jeff McClure, are you there?
I think I'm here, but you never can tell.
Well, I can tell.
Well, you actually could do that introduction to say, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and all the ships at sea.
But I don't think the ships have been listening for a very long time.
Yeah, well, Walter Winchell used to open up that way.
I don't even know who that is.
Oh, well, he was one of the pioneers in radio broadcasting.
Ah, so that's why I don't know who he is, because it's like saying he's one of the pioneers of vacuum tube lighting.
He was the equivalent of Walter Cronkite for radio.
Oh. And some of our younger listeners won't know who Walter Cronkite is.
That's true.
I know who Walter Cronkite is because I knew him.
I don't think there's anybody equivalent today, is there?
No.
Maybe Bill Nye, the science guy or something.
No, because he's gone hit one side of the political spectrum, doesn't trust him. Walter Cronkite was trusted by everybody.
He was.
Yeah.
So was Walter Winchell. Walter
Winchell is what you said the first time. So if I can't remember it, I can't correct you.
Well, that's good.
But what we can say, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll do our disclosures in just a moment. But what we were just talking about, that there used to be a single trusted voice of news. And you're like, oh, man, those were good times when people were just more trustworthy. We had less choices.
It really was Walter Winchell. That was his name.
Yeah. The if you have three networks or two networks and one of them doesn't get good reception, then you've got one person that you listen to. And if that's the only thing you're listening to, it's easy to trust that person. Even if everybody's trying to be trustworthy, there are still matters of opinion. Anyway, let's give our disclosures. That was a good disclosure just in pure across the board for every news source that you listen to. Be aware that everybody has an opinion, and it does tend to tinge what they're saying, including us. We just don't know what it is, or we wouldn't do it. It's the thing about blind biases is that you can't see them. You want to start the disclosures?
Now, would they be blind biases, or would they be invisible biases? A blind bias is one that can't see itself. I mean, it's blind.
Yeah, but see, it's a technical term in behavioral finance or behavioral psychology. It's called a blind bias. And it does seem to be anthropomorphizing the bias as if it can't see rather than we can't see it. It should be invisible, but I don't think you're going to get all the textbooks changed.
So we have invisible hands, but we have blind biases.
Yes.
Maybe because the blind bias can't see its hands, it's invisible.
Could be.
Anyway,
could be.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach. That's the name of the radio program, but it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which neither approves nor disapproves what we do. They're just the regulator that regulate us because we're a, quote, large.
We should just say, rather than they neither approve nor disapprove, we should just say, they say nothing about us.
Oh, they say lots of things about us.
No, we say stuff on their website about us. They don't really say anything about us unless we do something wrong. Or unless they found that we do something wrong. It doesn't mean we're not doing something wrong when they say nothing. Boy.
That makes entirely too much sense.
Yes.
Anyway, we are the Personal Wealth Coach. The radio program is, and it's also the name of a investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas. And the two principals on this show, the two guys who talk on this show, younger and older Baldy, are also principals at the Personal Wealth Coach. But that doesn't mean we're giving investment advice on the radio program. What we're giving is educational information, which is a different animal altogether than investment advice.
I would have to say it's not an animal, but you can go ahead and call it that if you wish.
Hey, look, if you can have a blind bias, investment advice could be an animal.
All right. As long as it's not an anemone, because that's just hard to say.
Where was I? Let's see.
Even though we are on the radio program, yeah. Education is different than investment advice.
Investment advice is given based on your particular circumstances, your risk tolerances, your situation, et cetera, objectives, whereas educational information applies to everybody. It's just information.
And hopefully it's beneficial. We can educate you on things that won't help you a bit, too, if you'd like. We're good at trivia.
That's what we've been doing so far on the show today.
Exactly.
Let's see. The next thing is that we do not pay for this radio program, nor does KTM pay us to do the radio program. However, we do advertise for the radio program on KTM.
Yes.
And let's see. The next, the information we present on here, which, by the way, should not be used to make investment choices, which sounds kind of wonky, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of that information.
So we deem but don't warranty or guarantee.
You got it.
So deem is very different than guarantee.
Right. But we don't redeem.
But do we deem that it has merit?
We do deem that it has merit.
Does that make it a demerit?
Deem merit.
Yeah, deem,
deem it
merit.
As merit.
You say it fast enough and it's a demerit.
Well, yeah, but we're both principals. If somebody comes to our office, they're not in trouble.
Well, we can give them demerits. All right, so this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we actually do talk about the economy a bit more than as much as we banter at the beginning. And today we got a lot to talk about.
What? Not much happened this week.
Well, I can tell you a few things that happened this week. We had...
The sun came up several times.
No. I'm going to argue with that. This is we're beginning the arguments between the economists already. I don't believe that the sun came up several times during the week.
All depends on your perspective.
I believe that the earth turned. But on the other hand, see, we got to throw the other hand in there because we're economists. From perspective, on a fixed point on the planet, it would appear that way, except that you can't have a fixed point on a moving object.
Well, you can, and
it's not fixed.
If it's not broken, it's fixed.
Duct tape. That's the solution to whether or not the sun rises or sets, is duct tape. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We have solved the problems of the world.
We have solved the problem. Let's talk about the markets.
All right.
The S&P 500 Stock Index, otherwise known as SPX, did its thing again this week and rose 0.72%, which doesn't sound like much until you multiply it times 52 weeks. But the big thing, as far as history and so on is concerned, is it closed at a record high on Friday of 3397.16, and it's actually up 0.33% than it was at the market top in February. Now, that's... That puts the Standard Poor's 500 up 5.15% this year. But there's a peculiarity in it. It was an article, a good article, that came out this week. Let me see where it came from. Called the K-shaped stock recovery.
The K-shaped? Is this a sideways K, or is it lying on
its
back?
Capital, you have the capital K.
Is it doing a push-up?
One's going up and one's going down. And
I think we're stretching the metaphors here a little. We're just trying to come up with letters. Is it a V? Is it a W? No, it's a K. Pretty soon we're going to have an S. What is that?
Well,
the stock market is hissing.
It's a K-shaped stock recovery because two sides of the market are behaving very differently. You've got a very small part of the market as far as the number of stocks is concerned, about 10. That now make up about 25% of the total value of the S&P, 29% of the value of the S&P 500. And this is what is driving the stock market up. But the average stock in the index, you just took the average value, the average price of the average stock in the index, of the 500 stocks, it's down 28.4% below the peak. And the value the value S&P 500 index is down about 12% for the year. This is a very, very large difference between the value and the growth side of the stock market. And the value side of the stock market reflects what's going on in the economy and what's like where the economy is likely to be in a year. The growth side of the economy, the growth side of the stock market right now is based on speculative bets, and mostly it is pretty speculative, that the growth in earnings that we're seeing in Amazon, in Walmart, in Lowe's, in Home Depot, and a whole series of other stocks like that that have boomed since the pandemic started is going to continue forever.
Yeah, and the reality is that those companies are making massive profits because of the pandemic, where other companies are making losses because of the pandemic. And if we believe in logic, we will know that at some point after a vaccination and we've got this under control, we got to say, will that happen? Well, I have a very, very high degree of confidence that we will have that happen. Okay, next layer. If that's going to happen, then people won't be stuck buying at home. They can go out and buy. And they won't be stuck saying, hey, we've been meaning to do this home improvement project for the last 10 years. Let's do it. Because they just did it. And they haven't been waiting 10 years now. Now they're waiting the 1 month since their last improvement project, which means that there might be less earnings in the future for some companies.
Yeah, I've read some articles about speculation as what's going to happen when we finally get a vaccine and get it deployed. And the one thing that all of the analysts agree on is that it's going to be frothy. It's going to be bumpy. We're going to see volatility in the market because you take a look at what is Amazon, 111, 120, something like that, times its earnings, the price. That is just absurdly high, and some people are going to hang on to it, but there's going to be a lot of people go back to shopping at the local stores, and that's going to change everything. I suspect people will still go back to the grocery store and start shopping again rather than picking up curbside, because it's far less convenient to pick up curbside. It's going to change the whole earnings picture dramatically.
We've got some things that are going to be different in our household coming forward. The local grocery store does delivery now. I don't see any reason why we would ever want to stop that. And they're delivering on the same day that we order. So for convenience sake, that's a lot better than putting in an order at a grocery store and having to wait a couple of days to go and pick it up and remember to do it. Where we put the order in the morning, and by that afternoon, we've got groceries being delivered. That's something I think we're going to stick with. And so there are parts of the new economy that are going to be permanent. And then there's other parts that aren't. And there's parts of the old economy that are gone for good.
There's one thing I can say with some degree of confidence. We have an economy that in the second quarter, the last quarter we have records were, we're now in the third quarter of the year. The economy dropped the most, had the greatest decrease in GDP in a single quarter since we've been keeping records. And if the most optimistic, it dropped about 9.5% in the second quarter.
Right.
That's not annualized. That's just in the quarter. The recovery, the best estimates I've seen on the recovery in the third quarter, and we are going to have a positive GDP, it looks like, is about 4.something%. In other words, and that's not half the 9, believe it or not. You have to get more than half. That's because of the way the percentages were. So we're not going to recover in the immediate future. And the IRS just came out with a very interesting number. I don't know if you saw that.
I've seen a lot of interesting numbers from the IRS. Is this the curse word interesting, or is this the this is very fascinating. Interesting.
It's fascinating, interesting.
Okay, that's a better kind of interesting with the IRS.
They're estimating that we will have 37%, we'll have a 37 million job deficit in 2021 compared with what we had at the end of 2019.
Well, that's interesting. And it kind of jibes well with what we're seeing in other areas. If the IRS is saying it, then it makes, I mean, they generally say it based on tax returns and revenue from taxes. They're getting payroll taxes and so on paid to them, so they have a pretty good finger on that pulse.
they're estimating it will take 5 years to recover all the jobs that were lost in this crisis. And their numbers are based on a lot of things, but one of the things that they're seeing and they're keeping records of is the number of businesses that just shut down. And they're not going, they have no intention of opening again.
Yeah.
And the way they're filing their taxes shows this.
What I'm seeing in surveys, which are, they've got a big margin of error right now because it's really hard to do these surveys. We're not going to really know this for several years. But as many as 20% of the small businesses that shut their doors have done so permanently at this point. And that's what I mean about parts of the old economy are gone for good. They're generally smaller businesses, but we've seen a lot of the big retail companies that were already on the rocks. They're gone now.
Neiman Marcus is kind of a landmark to me as the...
It's the hoity-toity, yeah.
Luxury department store, and it's in bankruptcy. And JCPenney, of course, went under. And Sears has gone under. Sears is acting like a submarine.
As I was, when I was a kid, my grandmother, your mother-in-law, used to do something that she would do with her kids, and that is get all dressed up like you're super fabulously wealthy, and we weren't at the time. In my mom's childhood, they certainly weren't either. And then they would go to fancy places, and she called it hussy-tussying. So in Jacksonville, Florida, when we went to visit her in the late 70s or early 90s, she took me and my brother hussy-tussying to Neiman Marcus. Now, we didn't buy anything, but we wandered around the store as if we could buy things. And so you were saying it's a landmark in your mind. It is for me, too. It was a store that was, in my mind, the equivalent of Rolex watches and Gucci. It wasn't quite at that level, but in my mind, it was. And it's gone. And it's gone because we've changed the way we buy. And then the last, it wasn't really a straw, was it? It wasn't a straw that broke the camel's back. The camel had a bunch of straw on it already, and then a log fell on it. It was the pandemic. That was the log that broke the camel's back. Go ahead.
Looking at the market, the rest of the market, let's first say another comment about the stock market. The last time we had this huge diversion between, huge divide between the growth and the value side of the S&P 500 was in the year 2000. And what happened is the economy had already started to slow down and was no longer going like a steam engine at full power. And the growth stocks kept going despite the fact that the economy was sagging. And the value stocks sagged appropriately, reflecting what was going on in the economy. And everybody said, nothing to worry about, nothing, no fear.
Don't worry about it.
It'll work out just fine. This could go on forever.
These dot-coms are fine, guys.
And I've read several comments, and I haven't actually heard them. I've read several comments that it's different this time. And these high growth stocks with earnings multiples that are just absurd, that none of us could possibly live long enough for the earnings of the stock to pay back the price of the stock. It's different this time because this is a pandemic and it's different and it's just, and there are going to be major changes and people will not go back to shopping in person. They will all stay at home forever. And I kind of think that that argument doesn't carry a lot of weight, but there's still a lot of speculation going on.
Right.
And I think
there are, that when we look at, you know, I like looking at Amazon, at Apple, these are two of the A in the old Fang. They're now called the Fa'ang with no G because Google's alphabet, there's an extra A. When we look at Amazon or at Apple, two fantastic companies. I mean, nobody can say that these are slackers. These are good companies. And their earnings are way up. But if you look at what their earnings are now and what people are pricing them to be if they continued these earnings, Amazon would have to sell you everything that you buy to be equivalent to what it's priced at today.
And they'd also have to sell everything the people in Africa buy and everything the people in China buy.
Right. And they're not going to be in China. And there are competing services in China that were intentionally set up by the Chinese government through their own governmental capitalism, if you can, some kind of weird Frankenstein. But they've done that kind of across the board with their cell phone companies and with basically anything that was being made in China or anything that we were doing over here. They wanted an equivalent that they could control. So they don't have Facebook over there. They have their own social medias. They don't have Amazon. They have their own online buying services. They basically just copied everything. And this is part of the problem that we've had with China for a long time, is intellectual property doesn't mean the same thing there as it does here. But that means that this big marketplace that in the past, Facebook and Apple and Tesla and everybody else is saying that's a target marketplace. Tesla's got a big plant that's opening up over there. Apple's got manufacturing facilities over there. The big plant that's opening up there for Tesla is to sell to Chinese, not to make things over there and bring it back, but to sell to Chinese. And the Chinese are developing their own electric cars now. So Tesla's factory, Gigafactory is what they call it. It's a factory. The Tesla's factory being built over there is about to, at some point in the next decade, run into some serious competition that is government-backed in China, which puts a real serious cap on what earnings they can make abroad in China. If we look at Amazon, Amazon's available across Europe. They don't have the kind of shipping facilities, the same kind of overnight or two-day shipping that we have here. And they could expand that. They could bring that up, but a lot of people in Europe already have some other version of something like it that they're using. So it's not like the early days of Amazon where they were just eating up the market share. They were just suddenly Amazon became a big name and there's really not any competition. That's the way we feel about it here, because you could go to Walmart.com and have the order there. That's really the other competition to Amazon. So having said that, do I expect to buy everything that I purchase from Amazon? No, I don't. At some point, I will balk at that. I will say, hey, there will be better deals in other locations. That's always the case. And when it was new and it was scrappy and it was always trying to get the best price and trying to get the fastest shipping, it's not that company anymore. It's a different company now. And when a company gets to a certain size, there's limitations on how much more it can grow. Apple is already there. They're at that maturity point where how many Apple computers are you going to own in your home at the same time? How many iPhones are you going to have in your pocket? And I know people that have multiple phones, one for business, one for work, but they're not going to carry four. They're not going to carry three. Two is a stretch, and they have trouble. They're already frustrated because they don't know which phone to answer when it's ringing.
Yeah, I read an interesting article that did an analysis of Apple's earnings and profitability. And one of the issues was that in order to remain profitable, Apple is going to have to figure out some way to charge $1,000 per iPhone.
Or, and this is what they've done in the past and why people have this faith in them, they come up with an absolutely new product that fits a niche that nobody even knew that they had. So that's what happened with the smartphones. It was iPhone. That was it. And they popped up with this thing. Before that, it was the iPod and then the iPad. And at each of those points, they introduced a product that essentially had no competition. But they haven't released a product in a completely new category for 10 years now. And what that means is that, well, what happened with that last product that was introduced, the iPad? Well, that was a baby of Steve Jobs. And he was really into new research and new development, new items, the new iPod, the new iPhone, the new iPad. All these things were completely new. And if there was something else out there that competed with them, it was on a very, very small scale where they had the ability to jump out there and make big waves. And they've just not been doing that sort of thing anymore. So now they are just needing to make you buy more of the same thing and maybe for a higher price. And there's a limit to that. Although, you know, the average price of a new vehicle in the United States is now right around $39,000. That's just the average price. And that means that prices are up across the board and in vehicles. And if you had told me that that was going to be the case 10 years ago, I would have said, no way. But we just keep adding more little bits and bells and whistles. We haven't really changed the gas mileage that much in the last decade. We haven't really changed much except for you got a little touch screen that you can do to change your AC rather than turning a knob. But usually the prices come up $4,000 or $5,000.
But there's another advantage to the cars today too. They don't wear out very fast.
That's right.
If you want to drive a typical American-made or a Japanese-made car for a couple of 100,000 miles, you can do so. Now, you'll probably get tired of it somewhere along the line, but the point is the reliability and the longevity of cars have gone up dramatically, and that is a reason, as have the loan periods. It used to be that when you bought a car, the longest loan period you could get from anybody was 3 years because the car would be worn out after 3 years. Then it went to 5 years, and now it's up to around 6 years, and they don't wear out after 6 years. They're still a perfectly good vehicle, and that's one of the reasons the price has gone up. But, you know, it shows my age, not accounting for inflation, that my parents bought a $35,000 house when I was in high school, and they didn't want anybody to know how much the house was worth because it would make everybody think they were rich.
That's a really nice house for $35,000.
Back then, yeah. I won't say how long ago that was, although you can guess it. But
somewhere around 122 years. That's a rough
estimate.
Something
like that.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little more about the market, if you don't mind.
There's
something we normally report on, and we report on it in the newsletter as well as in the radio program, and that is the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note. And that's an important thing. I was looking at some historic data on that. The Treasury yield curve has done a very, very good job over the last 50 years of forecasting literally every recession we've had. When it goes, when the yield curve goes negative, every time in the last 50 years, we've had a recession that followed within 18 months.
Yeah. And there's no way that the yield curve a year ago could have known that the pandemic was coming. But we were due for a recession anyway. You throw on the fact that we had a black swan as well, as that we were due for a recession, and that's part of the reason why we're hitting the bottom so hard.
Well, the U.S. Treasury note is yielding 0.635%, which is higher than the lowest it's been. It was down around 0.5%. And certainly it's higher than the 0.5% that it was yielding. But it's way down. It coasted up to nearly 1% a couple of months ago. But the key here is, think about the concept of loaning money, turning your money over to the United States government for 10 years. And they'll guarantee that after 10 years, you'll get your same number of dollars back that you gave them. But only getting 0.635% per year on that money that you loan to the United States government. And the president has talked about, and other people have talked about, negative interest rates. Inflation right now is running about 1.5 to 1.2. Actually, the latest report on it was 1.7%. So if inflation is running along at 1.7% a year and the government is only paying you 0.635% per year on your money, that is a negative real rate on the 10-year Treasury. I never would have dreamed that it would be this low ever. I remember when it used to be 6% when we had higher inflation. But in essence, what the Treasury yield is telling us is that the bond market, the Treasury bond market, which is where, by the way, the big money is seeing forward a very low recovery of the next year or so. Not a booming recovery. And so you got this big disagreement going on right now between the growth side of the market that seems to think that we're going to be immediately into a massive boom next year, and the U.S. Treasury note that's saying, nope, it's going to be about 3 years before things start to improve. Matter of fact, the yields out to 3 years are effectively zero on Treasury securities. So that is a big forecast differential, and I tend to think, well, and I said this sort of a minute ago, but when the growth stocks get this far above the rest of the market, in every case I can find in history, it has not ended well. And the other thing is you want to look out for is when somebody says this could go on forever, which I've read several times this week. And the other one is it's different this time, which I've read several times this week, which means that you might want to keep your seatbelt fastened, particularly if you're in one of those high-growth stocks.
Right. On that note, I'm going to share a little irony of another headline that doesn't have anything to do with what I'm about to say, but I think it's funny. Reading along through a financial journal, and there's a financial rag, and on one of the headlines says, the dangers of painting a generation with a broad brush. That's the headline. And then you come down one headline below that. Gen Z and millennials really are trading more in the COVID era. And that's the subject I wanted to talk about, but I just thought it was humorous that we've got a headline saying, hey, don't characterize everybody in a generation the same way, and then one headline below that, let's characterize everybody in a generation the same way, or two generations. So what we're saying here is that millennials and Gen Z, and for those of you who don't know what that is, that's basically the two youngest generations, are trading a lot more than they used to be during the pandemic. More than half of Gen Z and millennial investors said that they've been trading more often since the COVID-19 pandemic began. 30% of the overall population has said that they're trading more.
Trading stocks, you're talking about.
Trading stocks. E-Trade Financial Group is the one that put this survey out, and they polled people that were at Robinhood and at Fidelity and everywhere else, but E-Trade was the one that did the survey. 46% of younger investors said that they've traded derivatives more frequently. That's double the average rate. So what does that mean? It means that there's a lot of inexperienced investors. We have more access to the market right now than we've ever had before. You can download an app, put in some information, do a transfer through your app. You don't have to go and visit anybody. You can do these forms online in your app, and it's done. And now you can start making trades in short sales and options, puts and calls. And if you don't know what these are, you probably shouldn't be doing them. Straddles and spreads and all these things. And those are the extreme risky end of the trading area of the market. And that's where a lot of the trade volume is picking up in new investors. There's a real danger here. And we do have some Gen Z and millennial listeners that take our advice and that on the air are listening to the education. What I would say here is educate yourself before you make a trade that you don't understand, unless you're willing to lose all or in some cases more than you invest. Because in some cases, there's short sales are one of those cases, and there's a lot of short sellers out there right now. What is a short sale? It means that you borrowed a stock from someone else through an online means or through a brokerage means. You say, let me borrow that thing. I'll pay you a fee to let me borrow it. I'm going to sell it now because I think the stock market's going to go down. If the stock market goes the other direction, it goes up. At some point, you have to pay back the stock that you borrowed. All the shares that you borrowed, you paid a fee to borrow them, but you actually owe that back. It's a debt. And when the stock market goes up, when the price goes up on that, you get a call that's called a margin call. Hey, this is now more than you borrowed, and at some point, we're going to require you to pay for this. you can wind up very easily losing more than you invest in these types of trades. And they are so easily available now. The horror stories are written everywhere. Reddit is full of horror stories of people that said, I didn't even know what I was doing and I lost $80,000. How could I do that? I only had $10,000 in my account. This is a buyer beware situation. It is not the job of the app company, the trading platform, to tell you not to do things with your money that might damage you. It's your job to do that, unless you have a fiduciary advisor. Now, there are regulations that they're supposed to be following on the platform that's supposed to give you full warning of the types of risks that you're doing. But the full warning risk document is so thick and they look identical from one type of investment to another, nobody reads them. There's actually a millennial and Gen Z acronym that gets typed into text and everywhere else, TLDR, too long, didn't read. And that's how we feel about when you've got an update on your phone, please agree to these terms of service. They're only about 40,000 pages long and you don't have time to, you're trying to make a phone call right now. So on your iPhone or on your Android, you're probably not going to lose $40,000 by accepting the terms of service. You might lose a lot of money if you're not careful in these more risky trades.
So you can literally lose, if you're speculating, you can literally lose more than you invested.
Yes. And it's a danger, and a lot of people that have gone through this have recognized it after the fact and said, wait, I didn't know I could do that. Now, it's in all the documents that they clicked their signature on, but they didn't read them. So just be aware that if you're getting into trading and you think it's fun, you're doing it wrong. It is a job, and it can be interesting and fascinating. It should be able to build your portfolio. It shouldn't be something that you say, woohoo, I'm going to go trade some stocks.
Long-term, well-diversified investing is investing. Long-term and investing go together.
Yes. Short-term.
Short-term.
That's speculating.
You're jumping in and out. You're speculating. You might as well go to, actually, you'd have better odds in many cases if you went to Las Vegas.
Right. Because at least the gaming commission says that you can't rig the game against the people with really, really bad odds. And it's not that the stock market is rigged. It's that if you don't do your research and you're buying a company because the stock price is going up and it's in the middle of bankruptcy and somebody knew something you didn't know because they read about it, it may seem rigged because you didn't read about it. Doing research is vital, and people can lose more than their shirts on this. It's very expensive shirts. And we've got to play some commercials. Did you want to say anything before we do commercials?
Yeah, we have to play commercials.
All right, nice. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone lines are all full, but you can email in at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we will answer the question on the air. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure.
Or Jake and Jeff McClure.
Whichever way you want to go. And there's two of us in here, and sometimes there's only one of us in here physically. And sometimes since March, that has been the case. Since March. You know, we're... What's that?
24 weeks.
24 weeks. That's a long time.
It is. We're working our way up to half a year that we've been in isolation. Not fun.
Not fun.
Which reminds me, even Amazon is making investments that clearly indicate that they see people returning to their offices to work when this is over with.
Right.
And so are other stores. For instance, Simon Group, which is the largest mall owner in the United States, which looked like it was in trouble, and it was turning it's leasing out the big box stores that were on, that were the anchors in the malls, or at least it's in negotiation to do so, to Amazon, so they can use it for distribution center. But at the same time, the same group is buying up interests, large interests, in companies like Brooks Brothers that have declared bankruptcy, that were mall occupants before. In other words, there's some very smart money that's betting on the large-scale return to normalcy on the back end, but a large-scale return to normalcy without the big department stores. So it's kind of interesting, certainly to me, to watch the smart money. When I say the smart money, the money that has been successful for many, many years at the large scale, like the Simon Group, make their show by, and Amazon's show, by their investments, what they think is going to happen in the future.
Right. So Simon Group, that's the company that owns so many of the big malls across the country. Most of those malls are relatively empty, extremely empty compared to their heyday in the late 90s and early 2000s. And many of the major department stores are simply not there anymore. JCPenney's, Sears, Bell's, you just kind of go down the list, and many of them are gone. So you've got this massive amount of real estate that's just sitting there. And, you know, governmental agencies have moved in places, and sometimes hiring facilities have moved in. But it's such a large area. And Amazon is making a deal with Simon now to use that area as a warehouse facility, because most, this is one of those interesting demographic shifts. And the central areas of cities, the warehouses have been turned into condominiums. And now that our supply chain is threatened by the coronavirus, we're not getting the instant shipment from China that we were used to, or from Japan that we were used to, or from Thailand or anywhere else, because everything is slowed down, which means that there's a need for warehouses again. And unfortunately, the people that are living in those condos, they don't want to move out so that you can rip them down and convert it back into warehouses.
And they wouldn't work very well either, since they're in the inner city.
Right. So now you have these malls that are set up right near the center of every city that have these big, big, big empty spaces that look a lot like warehouses when you remove all of the fanciness that made it look like a department store, if you can call it fanciness. It was just the clothes and the smell of the cologne that they, or perfume that they kept attacking you with as you walked by. Sorry, I have a little bitterness there.
Another thing about this tremendous expansion in centers, and it seems like several times a week I read where Amazon is opening up a new distribution center someplace else. You think, wow, you know, if those distribution centers, which we used to call warehouses, are full of stuff that's being moved around, and you see the advertisements that Amazon has with all these people in there moving boxes around and labeling boxes and reading boxes, man, we're going to hire a lot of people. Well, the problem is their new centers, as they open them up, are almost entirely robotic. It's not like the advertisements you may be seeing on TV with lots of people running around with masks on and taking care of each other and being really cool. It's actually lots of robots running around in there.
And none of them are wearing masks. None of those robots are wearing masks.
Well, they have antivirus protection.
Oh, okay. All right. Then that's fine.
But the point is that what the pandemic has done and is doing is exactly what happened in the Great Recession of 1920-21. It's actually called the Forgotten Depression of 1920-21. It's accelerating a change that was already there. The internal combustion engine was taking over from animal power and steam power and water power in the 1920-1921 time frame. But the recession that was triggered largely by the what we call the Spanish flu that really originated in Kansas, it seems to have originated in Kansas, accelerated that
technological change tremendously because people were suddenly not available to work. They were sick or they were dying or they were just scared to come to work. And so the mechanization of our society accelerated quickly in the 1920-21 recession. The digitalization of our society is accelerating quickly in the 2020-2021 recession. And we're just repeating history.
Yeah. What we're accelerating here, it's not like this is new technology. We didn't just suddenly come up with the ability to work remotely. People have been saying that, hey, I'd like to work remotely. But over the last 5 years, we've had several swings back and forth with major companies where they say, everybody can work from home. And then they roll that back because there's too much confusion and the software's just not at a state where they can communicate at a level that they need to. So they roll it back. And then another company says, oh, we're going to go all remote. We have new technology for it. And then they roll that back. Well, I don't think it's going to get rolled back as far. The San Francisco Bay Area, and I said this at the end of last week's program, the San Francisco Bay Area houses many of the most prestigious tech companies in the world, places where they work. And Apple is saying, you're not coming back to work till January, maybe later. And at some point they may say, you don't have to come back to work, you just stay off. And the survey that I was reading, was posted in the Wall Street Journal last week, was that 40% of the tech company employees that live in that ultra high priced area of San Francisco Bay said that if their companies said that they could work remotely forever, they would move. And it seems like, well, of course they would move. It's really a high priced area. Well, it isn't, and of course they would move a year ago. If somebody has said, hey, we're going to let you work remotely, are you going to move? The vast majority of them would have said, no way. The pleasures of living in this ritzy, fancy area of town, you can go out and see music, you can go out to the club, you can, all the things you can't do right now. So, again, I want to take that survey that I read last week and just repeated with a grain of salt. Because we're going to possibly see some of that roll back. But I think we've made some huge leaps in the ability to work remotely. I don't see a reason why we would have as many people in our office in the future as we did in the past.
Well, you know, that's reflected in another economic statistic from this week, or actually from July. In July, the sales of existing homes jumped 24.7% from June. And the new home sales are up about 22% at the same time, 22.6% from June.
But the fascinating part is where they're being purchased.
They're being purchased in rural areas.
Rural and suburban areas outside of major cities. You're not seeing that in... Go ahead.
We're seeing an exodus from the major cities.
Yeah, exactly. What we're seeing in Manhattan and in San Francisco and in... Portland, we're not seeing it in Austin. Austin inner city prices have continued to go up and people are buying a lot more inside Austin, which is a strange thought in itself. Why is Austin acting differently on the real estate market than elsewhere? And I think it's because of live music and because of big open spaces inside the city. People aren't as packed closely together. And the real estate prices are not as obscene as they are in San Francisco and Manhattan. But they'll get that way if they just continue on the road that they're on. And that means that this is the cusp of it's the beginning of the outward flow from the cities. And people hear me say that and they're like, why are you predicting it like this? Because this is what we do in a pattern in history. We have these inflows and we have these outflows. And it has to do with transportation, has to do with ability to work outside of the city and then back in the city. And I was predicting it before in 5 to 10 years from now, based on self-driving cars bringing traffic down, you could live farther away from the city and still get in there. I didn't think the technology to work remotely was going to be ready for 10 years because it's taking so long. Well, we've had such a huge leap forward now. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think it may be 2 to 5 years instead of 5 to 10.
I recently spoke to a professional who already works from home. He's a software developer. And he could work anywhere. He could do anything he wanted to. The problem is that he's looking at his property taxes in Austin. He's looking at the cost of living in Austin as it goes up every year. And he's going on vacation in North Carolina. And he goes and does an Airbnb in North Carolina, and he sees the price of the house and realizes he can afford it, but we're out of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So he may be moving to North Carolina is what you're saying?
Yeah, to the mountains of North Carolina. Why not? He can buy a house that's 10 times the size of the house he has in Austin for the same price.
Right. And soon we'll have broadband all over the world. So, yeah. Well, we're out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail available locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's a contact us form there. You can email us, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. While you're on the web page, you can read our newsletters, sign up for newsletters for weekly, or listen to recordings from the past.